While you are busy enjoying your lunch, while you are busy having some time from 1300 hours, take time and listen to OTR News Bulletin.
On the radio news analysis, we go beyond the headlines. We don't just tell you what's happening. We ask why it's happening, how it affects ordinary Namibians, and what it means for the country's future. We examine the structures behind news, connect policy to people's lived realities, and bring in expert voices to make sense of where Namibia is heading.
You want to get into touch with global governance, global diplomacy, economic relations, trade, statistics, human and infrastructure development, and you want to see how policy planning and policy implementation is connected in Namibia. Make time and listen to OTR from 1300 hours to 1430 with Happy Juju.
Eagle FM, the eye.
A very good afternoon, Namibia, and a warm welcome to On the Reading News Analysis right here on your number one talk radio station, Eagle FM. I'm your host, Ndafa Happy Juju, and today is Wednesday, the 25th of March, 2026. Now, this afternoon, we turn our focus to the key developments shaping Namibia's national conversation, from economic trends and governance to innovation, business, and youth empowerment. Now, these are not just headlines. They are the forces influencing policy direction, economic opportunities, and the everyday realities of people across the country. On the Reading News Analysis is more than a news update. It is a platform for in-depth analysis and understanding. Here, we go beyond simply reporting events. We unpack the why and how behind the news, examine the data and decisions driving change, and explore what it all means for Namibia's future. Now, over the next 90 minutes, we'll break down major stories, engage with key perspectives, and connect the dots between policy, economics, and society. Now, whether it's a shift in the economy, a new government initiative, or emerging opportunities for young people, our goal is to provide clarity and insight that empowers you as a listener. Now, in a fast-moving and information-rich world, understanding context is just as important as knowing the facts. That's why On the Reading News Analysis is committed to delivering a credible information, balanced analysis, and meaningful conversations that help you stay informed, aware, and prepared. So wherever you're tuning in from this afternoon, across Namibia's towns, cities, and communities, we appreciate you for joining us. This right here is On the Reading News Analysis on Eagle FM Namibia, not just reporting the news, but helping you to understand it. Now let's get right into today's discussion. Today we dive deeper to take a closer look on understanding the role of data in an economy and beyond numbers to human impact. Now, in an economy, data plays a central role in shaping decisions, policies, and development outcomes. Institutions such as the Namibia Statistics Agency and the Bank of Namibia collect and publish data that reflects the realities of a country's population and economic performance. However, the true value of this data lies not just in collection, but in how it is utilized and interpreted. In an information sharing session held at the Government Information Sharing Center aimed at strengthening the understanding and the use of official data in Namibia was held at the Government Information Sharing Center featuring Ipumbu Sakaria, Manager for Corporate Communications at the Namibia Statistics Agency. Now, during this session, Sakaria provided insight into the mandate of the Namibia Statistics Agency as the country's central authority for the production and dissemination of official statistics. He explained that the agency is responsible for conducting national surveys and census, compiling economic and social indicators, and ensuring that data produced meets international standards of accuracy, reliability, and comparability. Now, in the discussion, Ipumbu Sakaria emphasized that statistics are a critical tool for evidence-based decision-making, and he noted that government institutions rely on NSA data to formulate policies, allocate resources, and monitor development outcomes in line with national priorities, such as the economic growth, employment creation, and poverty reduction. He further highlighted that the NSA regularly publishes key data sets, including population and housing census results, labor force statistics, consumer price indices or inflation and national accounts data. Now, these data sets, he explained, are widely used not only by government, but also by the private sector, development partners, researchers, and civil society organizations to guide planning and invest decisions. Ibu Zakaria also stressed the importance of data accessibility and public engagement, encourage stakeholders to actively utilize public available reports and databases, noting that informed data use pattern strengthens transparency, accountability, and public participation in governance. Ibu Zakaria also noted on Namibia's population being widely made up of the youth and also the unemployment that is centered around the youth, and therefore calling also on implementation of making use of this data in order to guide policy decisions be made in addressing this disparities or inequalities. For now, let's take a listen to that engagement and get a further understanding into it.
So the dissemination drive is really, when you conduct such a huge exercise, which costs you a lot of money, in terms of time, also costs you a lot of time to prepare, time to execute and implement whatever you need to do.
Mm-hmm.
It makes absolutely no sense to collect the data and keep it to yourself.
Mm-hmm.
The Statistics Act, it requires us to share or release or disseminate the information that we collect with the to the nation.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a requirement. We are not allowed to conduct or collect data and literally keep it to ourselves. We're not allowed to do that
mm-hmm.
by law. So what we have done is, ever since we released the data, we formally engaged all of our stakeholders
mm-hmm.
to share the data with them. The modus of operandi was actually very simple. We had a huge stakeholder list of all the significant stakeholders that we need to see, that we need to share the data with.
Mm-hmm.
And our modus of operandi was underpinned by a principle that said, if we found it necessary to ask you for assistance
mm-hmm.
for the census, we found it also necessary that we come back to you, report back to you, and inform you what is the data that we have acquired.
Okay.
So that even next time we have data collection exercises, you might just be willing to participate in it because we came back to you.
These are the stakeholders.
These are the stakeholders. Mm-hmm. So our stakeholders, they were various. It was a huge list comprising, of course, of government leaders,
mm-hmm.
Regional local authority leaders, students, private sector, all kinds of institutions, all kinds of clusters.
Mm-hmm.
So ever since the data was released officially in October 2024, we, after that, embarked on a massive dissemination strategy or implementation program where we essentially went and presented the data to the various stakeholders.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we specialized or ensured that we focus the discussion to the audience. For example, let's say you're going to the banking sector, you'll make sure that you have as much information that you have collected which relates to the banking sector with mm-hmm. them. When you go to the government, you do the same. When you go to the private sector, you do the same. When mm-hmm. you go to the students, you do the same. So it was quite a hectic exercise.
Mm-hmm.
We crisscrossed the country. We went to see all relevant stakeholders that we literally ask for assistance, and mm-hmm. as well those that we think need the data for their planning, monitoring, and for whatever purposes.
Mm-hmm.
And we went about to do that. I think it was quite successful. Maybe time was probably not the... We didn't probably have all the time that we wanted to do a bit more, but of course we still have time to continue to do so.
Mm-hmm.
But we are quite happy with most of the stakeholders that we've seen
mm-hmm.
because we were able to get the statistics to them,
mm-hmm.
which of course they found relevant and necessary for their development planning or whatever that they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
So we can actually say we are quite satisfied, but of course it's going to continue. It's an ongoing process and mm-hmm. we shall continue to do so.
Mm-hmm.
What they provide is, Namibia is a diverse country,
mm-hmm.
very, very diverse. what you might find in Karas region is not necessarily what you'll find in Erongo region or in Omaheke or Kunene. So number one is extreme diversity.
Mm-hmm.
Namibia is a very, very, very diverse country, not just from a population perspective, but in this aspect we looked at your demographics, so population was the most dominant one.
Mm-hmm.
Critically, there were some regions where you had a major change of population dynamics over the past 10, 12 years. Examples is, for example, Kavango East, Zambezi, Ochodonjupa, and I think Commerce itself, where you had quite a very significant increase in population dynamics in mm-hmm. those specific regions. You also had interesting data where, for example, your most populous region, of course, is Commerce. Of course, it hosts the capital city, which mm-hmm. attracts the most people to its establishment for obvious reasons, mm-hmm. opportunities, education, etc. But you also have regions such as your Karas region and Omaheke region.
Wahara kukufundinga mesindano joshimara kuzapoma wabi umilongo hitatu ukapo mbanda shangika ano ngundoe yetanga mama tigathana wotza ya kuku Easter tournament chito taikakara kumu masiku watatu siku wakamano wapi umpogo tungu poka pareke tanga kotza ya kuku Meheke district umalzano kwa unjuka adhana adeli kwa opo ya kareli kuhi umvura umilongo ndatu nantano monote avuro kusindana ushimara shumara umilongo hamano nantano kwa umuma shangika ano ngundoe nina kia ovilime numathiri gane na milongo ntano hadi Ketuti. Kwambo noe na omvura o milongo ndatu na hamano shuka pombanda. Otabu kusa ombinga, mo legends category, category kaa kokere. Mono to sindana shumarwa o maovi o mulongo na wakheali, no mathiri gatano kwa umuma. Shangi kandu no ngunduwe, no mathiri gatano keovi ali ketuti. Uka donu uonjuka. Tseye kuku annual Easter tournament, na naini mpatira konje, shangi kano ongunduwe, no mathiri gatano, no dara o mathiri gatano ali ketuti. Koma uyele gawe wako, bengela nakapa, kuno rano kita tuno imwe, o imwe none, omba Bariari, ontano, nondatu no hamano. Nenge kuda silva, kono mwa nofita tu no imwe, uheari nondatu, datu heari, hongoi, nondatu yari.
Also have regions such as your Karas region and Omaheke region, which, for example, showed that your town, just of Rundu alone,
mm-hmm.
has a higher population than Karas region,
mm-hmm.
and also a higher population than your Omaheke region. So the dynamics were quite very, very interesting. A lot of data was confirmed, was found. So the regions, the most populous regions, of course, in the country are your Commerce region,
mm-hmm.
followed of course by Ohangwena region, Omsatsi, Oshana and Toshkoto, and then the least populated are your Karas region, Hadap region, as well as your Omaheke region.
Mm-hmm.
Also, what it showed is that Namibia is a very youthful nation.
Yes.
Very, very youthful nation. 71% mm-hmm. of our population is below 35 years old.
Mm-hmm.
You also have a very significant proportion of those that are up to 14 years old. It's also a very, very high population groups. And then you start seeing that your dynamics in terms of your elders
mm-hmm.
Starts shrinking drastically. I think those that are above 60 years of age are roughly only 7% of the population,
mm-hmm.
which is quite a very interesting data.
Yeah.
And also just when you look at your independence, 36 years after independence, you'll see that 72% of our nation was actually born after 1990,
mm-hmm.
which really emphasizes your youthfulness. And then, of course, we have a lot of other data, housing data, employment data, and migration data. Migration, I think, very significant because what you see amongst the regions, you can clearly see who moves where to.
Yes.
So your Commerce region and your Erongo region are the two regions that attract the largest influx of people for obvious reasons. Of course, in Rongo, you have your mining sector, you have your fishing sector. Mm-hmm. It's an economic hub. Your commerce region, of course, is the center. It's your capital city. It attracts a lot of people. It has around 482,000 people. Mm-hmm. It's a good sixth of the whole country. And then you also have indicators that clearly shows that the people that generally move from their regions, predominantly, of course, Ohangwena region as well as the Onsati region. So such data is available. Then, of course, you also get data on urbanization. Mm-hmm. Remember, at 1991, a good 70% of Namibia's population lived in the rural areas. However, by now, we stand clearly at around 50%. So 50% of your population lives in urban areas, the other 50% in rural areas. Mm-hmm. What does that tell you about planning? What do you have to do in the urban areas to be able to absorb such a huge population group in terms of services, schools, all these kind of things that people need? So urbanization, very, very dominant. And I think there's also an element of, we have a lot of unmarried people in Namibia, especially when you look at the age group of 15 years and above. Why 15 years and above? Of course, you also want to measure potential child marriages, etc. But a good 70% of eligible people are not married. Mm-hmm. Of course, it explains it's a youthful population, very, very youthful population, but you have such socio-economic or demographic realities. Yes, education, of course, what we have seen over the years is the literacy rate has just declined slightly from 89% to 87%, but that is more related to your influx of migrants, especially from Angola and other countries that might maybe have come in for employment or whatever reason, but they might not be as literate as you probably would want them to be. But the information, massive information, like I said, from the regional profiles, some areas are very rural, some areas are predominantly urban. Yes. Erongo region, for example, 90% of the population is urban, as in contrast, for example, maybe to Kabango East or Omsati region, where you still have a 70-30-80-20 dynamics. Then, of course, the other data that comes out, of course, is employment. I think by now we are aware that our unemployment is quite high. You have, of course, your strict definition, which stands at 36.9%. But then for planning purposes, you also look at your broad potential unemployment, which is the one that rather raises alarm, simply because it's pretty high considering your youthful population, and the fact that, of course, Namibia is considered resource-wise quite a rich country, so it's quite a dichotomy of why you are in a rich country with generally not really you're poor, but a lot of people that can't find employment, etc. Yes, from a dissemination drive, remember Namibia is vast.
Yes.
So on the dissemination drive, it's just that you need to try to reach each and every corner. So what we were doing literally, we had a top-bottom approach where we go to each region, to each major city, local authority or city, to each generally big university, your regional police headquarters, all kinds of institutions that you have. So that really didn't pose too much of a challenge in terms of disseminating data, because our role is really just to share the data that is there and make it make sense for people. Okay. But I think the challenge is really is your development planning, because your services must reach people everywhere in the country. Now, you know, Namibia is a very sparsely populated country, second least densely populated country after Mongolia. which means you have to drive vast distances or cover vast distances just to reach people.
Yes.
Of course, even during the census planning, when we're collecting the data, we had to go everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And in some areas, we find a lot of people. In some areas, we hardly find any people. And it poses its own challenges and makes things a little bit more expensive than what you would want them to be. For example was Kunene, for example,
mm-hmm.
where you'd have to go to all kinds of areas, whether it's now Prefontaine, whether it's a Pupa,
mm-hmm.
you have Kamanyap again, Ucho, such a vast space. Karas region, the same,
mm-hmm.
densely populated area, unlike, for example, now, let's say, Oshana region that is generally higher densely populated as well as the Usati region. But from a dissemination perspective, that really didn't give us a headache, but for planning purposes, I think that is more of a challenge.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, now, how will this regional data support regional government and local authorities?
All right. Brilliant. It's how will it help? It's information.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever you need to do, when you plan, monitor development or whatever initiatives that you want to do, you need data. Now, for example, the data allows you to first understand, I'm in this region. This is the population of my region. This is the population of my town.
Mm-hmm.
These are the people that I'm serving. What are the resources that come to me in terms of being able to do whatever I want to do? So budgeting plays a very big role. It mm-hmm. can inform budgeting. Somebody can, for example, say, I'm having this huge population to take, to look after. Mm-hmm. However, the resources that you give me are nowhere close to what we ought to do.
Mm-hmm.
Number one. Number two, of course, we also have your GIS-enabled information where you are able to look at infrastructure, how far infrastructure is from the population, whoever needs it, and you'll be able to say, in this area, there are so many people, however, there are only so many schools.
Mm-hmm.
Or kids walk such long distances to schools. Maybe for planning purposes, we might want to put a school here or there, or a clinic there and not there, simply based on information. So it makes your whole planning much better, much more reasonable, and you are much easier able to provide services to the population because you plan accordingly. I'll give an example.
Mm-hmm.
If in one area there may be 200,000 people and in the other area there may be just 50,000 people, if you don't plan properly, you might want to build more schools in an area where there are only 50,000 people,
mm-hmm.
and you provide that same number of school facilities to the area that has 300,000 people,
mm-hmm.
which at the end might look equal, but in terms of equitable resource distribution, you have actually not really been very effective. You haven't done justice to what is on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
So data allows you to plan properly,
yes.
plan accordingly. Now, mm-hmm. the same with the challenge that we have of employment or unemployment. So it's important to understand, who are the unemployed? Where are they?
Mm-hmm.
What do they do? Why are they unemployed? All this kind of data. Is it lack of education? Is it lack of qualifications? It gives you a lot of data, and that allows you then to come up with targeted interventions to address the issues that you want to address. But like we always say, planning anything without data,
mm-hmm.
it's like you close your eyes and you want to cross the road.
Yes.
It's quite risky.
Mm-hmm.
You are better off opening your eyes and seeing, okay, there's a danger here, or now the road is clear. You are just better off making use of data than not. The same mm-hmm. with monitoring.
Mm-hmm.
We are having NDP6 now. We just came from NDP5. We're headed to Vision 2030. How will the government know that they've actually achieved their targets? You'll only know it if you if you look at what is it that you wanted to attain and what does the data say on the ground.
Yes.
And that is why it's important for us to be providing data so that we'll be able to see whether we're close to our targets or not and where we want to improve whatever we ought to do. The engagement was very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Where you present data and your audiences actually engage you in that data. Where either they have questions or they dispute the data or they agree with the data,
mm-hmm.
or they say, I didn't know about this data, or often it confirms something. I'll give an example. When we're in the Oshana region, when we're presenting to the governor as well as the council, our data showed that access to water was very high.
Mm-hmm.
It was then interesting to have the governor tell us that he agrees with this data, because when he went to familiarize himself with the region, one of the things that he found out from his councillors and everybody else is that access to potable water was not a problem.
Oshana region,
for example, mm-hmm. the majority of people had access to potable water, so mm-hmm. they could clearly agree with the data that I think this is correct. You also had other discussions that were quite of interest, where ownership of homes, mm-hmm. households, who owns households, is it male or females? That was quite interesting. Where in some areas, especially urban areas, you had a predominance of female-headed households,
mm-hmm.
as compared to male-headed households.
Mm-hmm.
Then it was always a very interesting debate of, what is going on here? Where are the men? Are they not supposed to be heading the homes?
Mm-hmm.
Why are these homes headed by women? Of course, we just provide the data. We analyze, but we also allow researchers to go deeper into the information and try to figure out what is the situation.
Okay.
In some areas, you had interesting data of male to female ratio,
mm-hmm.
where some people would say, wow, this is so nice, maybe we need polygamy, for example, simply because of data.
Mm-hmm.
Or you would have local authorities that then start telling you that, no, look at our situation. Why am I getting this type of budget if, for example, my population is larger than a whole region or two regions?
Mm-hmm.
Why do I get resources that do not match whatever I ought to do? So a lot of dynamics came out simply because of data.
Mm-hmm.
It always provided a very interesting ground of discussion. But one of the things that probably came out was appreciation that we came back to provide feedback,
mm-hmm.
because it's one thing to ask people to do something for you, and then once you get it, you are quiet. From us in corporate communication at the NSA, it's a crime. We believe that as much as we ask the nation to provide us with data, to us it is very, very critical that we come back to you,
mm-hmm.
and say, thank you for providing us this data. Now, these are the findings
yes.
we have,
mm-hmm.
and you now see how you're going to make use of it,
mm-hmm.
because we're going to need you again, we're going to come back again, and we don't want people to say, no, but you've been here before, you've never given us information. However, if you continue engaging people, they start seeing the usefulness of the data,
mm-hmm.
and they will understand why you collect this type of information, and then of course they can also make use of it for their own planning and monitoring.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of usefulness, we recently released your informal baseline report,
mm-hmm.
that looked at the population, that looked at informal settlements, and we managed to invite quite a lot of significant stakeholders, local authorities, regional government, etc. And the findings themselves, they were so interesting that it generated very, very lively debates. And also we saw through the major commitments from local authorities to say, no, we are going to have a look at it. Siege of Windhoek is one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Where you, of course, have a lot of informal settlements. And I think a week ago, something in the papers, there was us an indication that they say that they are going to have an in-depth look at this. They actually didn't know the situation was that severe or that serious. And that is what we want our data to do. Our data is for development. It should enhance development. It should make the lives of Namibians easier mm-hmm. by simply providing information to those that plan and monitor to ensure that we are able to fit those small holes that have that exist, so that we can. We are a very youthful population. That is one.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, to then show you that development planning must consider these young people because they are the majority of your population.
Mm-hmm.
Number three, you would want to look at your socioeconomics of the country. Because as often, of course, as it is mentioned, we are a rich country
mm-hmm.
with poor people. That is out of order. Our inequality is one of the highest in the world.
Mm-hmm.
It's nothing to be proud of. We are probably the third after Brazil and South Africa. And we must not shy away from discussing such things
mm-hmm.
because it's the reality on the ground. The potential is there. The resources are there. We must just find a way to distribute our resources more equitable. And also what the main message that probably I would want people to know is that we appreciate them participating in our surveys.
Mm-hmm.
They must not get tired of us. We are going to continue coming back to them because we have a lot of data collection exercises.
Mm-hmm.
The information will always be shared with them. And we also want to make people aware that you do not have to plan in darkness.
Mm-hmm.
The data is there. Most of the data that you would want or that you might think is not there, we have it.
Okay.
We'll give it to you for free and just ask us. We'll be shocked by what type of data we have
mm-hmm.
and we want it to go out. So the message is, Namibians, let's make use of statistics. It can make your life easier, your planning better, and we are more than willing to provide you the data that you have given us free when we came to collect this such data from you.
And now let's get a deeper understanding on the importance of data collection. Now, data collection is the foundation of informed decision making. Without accurate and reliable data, governments and organizations operate in uncertainty. That is, capturing reality, data collection helps to measure key indicators such as population size, employment levels, income distribution, inflation, and economic growth. It reveals where resources are most needed by identifying needs, whether in education, healthcare, housing, or infrastructure. Also, regular data collection allows countries to monitor development over time and assess whether policies are working. Therefore, it helps them in tracking progress. For example, census data collected by National Statistics Agency provides insights into population growth and distribution, which is critical for planning schools, hospitals, and transport systems. Now, collecting data alone is not enough. It must be actively used. Now, governments use data to design policies that address real challenges such as unemployment or inflation, therefore guiding policy development. And also, central banks and financial institutions rely on data to guide monetary policy, interest rates, and financial stability. Therefore, it should help in economic planning. Companies also use market and consumer data to decide where to invest, what to produce, and how to price goods, therefore may helping them in business decision making. Also, data ensures that limited resources are distributed efficiently and fairly, therefore guiding them in resource allocation. But the question remains, is data being effectively utilized, therefore helping it to leading it into making smarter decisions and also playing its part in reducing waste and better and therefore planning better outcomes for society? That we tackle in a discussion alongside a trade analyst. Nonetheless, there is an importance in correct data interpretation. because even high quality data can be misleading if it is not properly interpreted. Now, misleading data can lead to poor decisions, not because the data itself was poorly conducted or was not properly disseminated, but because it is wrongly being interpreted or being neglected altogether. For example, a drop in unemployment rate might seem positive, but if many people have stopped looking for work, the reality may actually be different. Therefore, context matters, as data must be analyzed within a social, economic, and historical context to draw meaningful conclusions and not just relying on statistics itself and not just relying on the numbers that are presented on the table for that particular moment in time itself. Therefore, proper interpretation transforms raw numbers into actionable knowledge that can guide change, turning data into insight. Therefore, skilled interpretation ensures that data tells the true story of what is happening in an economy. And there is also a need to look at worst case scenario. As much as the data may be reflecting something positive, there might be actually worst case scenarios which need to be looked at, which one person's data collected on that worst case scenario might not actually reflect in the overall data that is presented. Now, one of the most important shifts in thinking is to view data not just as a statistics, but as a representation of real people's lives. That is, every number reflects an individual or a household. An unemployment rate is not just a percentage. It represents people who are struggling to find employment, for instance, and support their families. Therefore, we need to humanize data. And then when policymakers see data as a human story, they are more likely to design inclusive and compassionate policies, therefore guiding them in empathy, or having empathy in their decision making. And development is not about improving numbers on a chart, but about improving the reality of livelihoods for citizens, for better jobs, better education, healthcare, and opportunities. They're looking at the real impact. For example, a rise in food price is not just an inflation statistics. It means families may be forced to skip meals or make difficult financial choices, such as taking a loan, going to a cash loan, which in the long run will actually affect their livelihood. So when data is properly collected, effectively used, and accurately interpreted, with a human-centered perspective, it becomes a powerful tool for transformation. It drives inclusive growth by ensuring no group is overlooked. It improves accountability as citizens can track progress and demand a better governance. It supports long-term planning in helping economies become more resilient to shocks, and it bridges inequality gaps by highlighting disparities and targeting interventions. But nonetheless, let's now take a listen to that conversation I had with Rodney Horb, who is a trade analyst at the Namibia Trade Forum. A very good afternoon to you, Mr. Rodney Horb, and welcome to On The Reader News Analysis.
Good afternoon, and thank you for having me, Ms. Happy.
Sure. It's a pleasure always to engage you, sir.
Okay. That's great.
Now, of course, today we're talking about the importance of data collection and data utilization for an economy, any economy, actually. Of course, we would look at within Namibia's economy, but overall, the collection of data, the correct interpretation of data, and then the correct utilization of data. Just getting to us on why data collection, data utilization is also very important.
Thank you, Ms. Happy. Data collection plays a public service role as well as the role of being a commercial product as well, depending on how advanced an economy is and how seriously they undertake this data as a data currency, as they would call it rightly.
Mm-hmm.
Data helps you better understand the analytics in the economy, meaning if you want to start initiatives, everything that you want to plot around the growth and the trajectory of your economy in the long-term planning, you strongly need to rely on data. And as a scholar of data per se, both economics and computer science, I believe it helps me and shapes me to understand that GDP data, for example, helps us to understand the planning landscape, the growth landscape within the three primary sectors of the economy. It helps us to understand how the national account, as we rightly call it, is collected, or in the earnings of the country in terms of that its revenue position and where it is planning to grow. So that basically sets the scene and how this changes from year to year. And then also the other most important data segments, like your CPI or the Consumer Price Index, helps you in terms of planning how you measure inflationary behavior, because Namibia, Africa is very much a proponent of having inflationary dependence in setting their monetary policy. So basically, in that sense, but primarily as well, data has become a very much commercialized product, where analytics help you in understanding your market base, your consumer base. It helps you understand the dynamics of peri-urban and urban expectations and in demand, and setting up the demand and supply structure of your country for any product, raw materials and inputs and all that.
Correct. Now, in an event where these data gaps, how can data gaps in data collection affect trade analysis and policy recommendations?
In trade analysis, it is very serious because trade analysis depends on tariff settings, and it also depends on import-export data. And then with that, basically how you do your trade surplus and understand what your position is in terms of your local production vis-a-vis your export. But there's also one significant important data segment that we have to take in consideration, which is the manufacturing value added. It determines on how much your country adds value to products within the economy, and then create a market, a strong industrial base without before sending it out. So it helps you to understand when you have this and what your position is. Then you can allocate whether, you know, your resources and policies to either have.
Phew, what a day. Finally on my way home. And hey, the taxi's empty. So much room. Oh no, why is this big guy getting in and sitting on top of me? No, not the mimi with the big bag too. Now I'm squeezed.
Sometimes in life, you just get squeezed. But luckily, with Express Credit's term loans, you can get up to 32,000 Namibian dollars to help ease your financial squeeze in under 15 minutes.
Ah, now that's a relief.
Visit expresscredit.com.na. Express Credit, money when you need it.
You know, your resources and policies to either have it very defensive or defensive position or safeguard some sectors. Even what we call the infant industries to protect them, the MSME and the informal trade sectors to protect them in that sense. So it helps you basically to draft your policies at a domestic level, and also helps you how you're going to engage at a regional level, because data helps you also to follow the trail of trade interchanges and transactions at pretty much a regional level, which is where we have the SACU, where we make most of our revenue, and then the SADC regions, and then also now where we are going to the AfCFTA level. Also, you know how we trade with other WTO members. So it helps you basically in that sense. But then one of the key policy recommendations where we are now, for example, in the oil sector, data plays a critical role in shaping, it will help a lot in shaping that policy. Because that's what we can call data availability. So it doesn't just speak to numbers and analytics. It also speaks about the policies that you have, the policy instruments, which is the legal text that you have. So the legal text is also weighted in the same way, how they can affect an outcome of an industry. So I say it for a long shot, there is a gap in how we publicize some data, the ownership aspect of such data. That there is not yet enough transparency where analysts like myself can go 24/7 and localized, locally owned, locally shaped and locally endorsed data in some segments. That also encapsulates the fishing sector. We need to have data all the way all around to understand the analytics between our fisheries, how the performance in the major export lines, the production lines, the catches. I think someone came to me and said they once traveled and they were so impressed that Aramco in Saudi Arabia has a trail of every oil drop, whether it is from food level up to the refined level that they produce within their country, because it helps them with that line of transparency and openness. And I think we should start at a very grassroots level, at a very preliminary stage where we are now, to prepare ourselves for data openness, which I really don't see yet, especially in the oil and gas prospects that we are planning.
Interesting one, that right there. Now, Mr. Rodney, in the event or in the areas where there is data that is released and made available, for instance, we do have the Namibia Statistics Agency, and also we had the Bank of Namibia release a report on Namibia's formal and informal economy. Do you think, in your opinion, such data is utilized, and perhaps is it well interpreted by those by institutions that need to then use this, the statistics in making certain decisions, even for instance in budget planning?
Yes, that's a very good question and a very good observation. Helping the informal sector, for example, should become the basis on commercial banks, especially the development banks, how they establish their funding outlooks for this year. Having read that document myself, and I think it's a good basis to start where stakeholders, whether in public or private sector, can establish their implementation plans. So now it is not an easy thing to do because, for example, that document speaks about formalization, the gaps that exist, how you can take miniature MSMEs, informal sectors, and help them in formalizing their trade. Although I'm a bit careful about interventionist tactics, one critical benefit of formalization is it helps you for visibility and then trust. It also helps the business to have a good trail of documentation, and then it also gives that strong support for revenue collection in the country, which everybody needs, because through revenue collection is where we optimize the strength. So now we have a lot of MSMEs and informal sector which exist in a vacuum, and but then they think that formalization will only expose them to more levels of micro you know, regulation, interferences, and then also maybe keep them backward in terms of their business practices, which are swifter and faster, we understand. But I think data analytics at that level will help us understand how we can bring services closer to the MSME and the informal sector. Because one has to see, for example, I go around sometimes. If I go Sunday afternoons to ShopRite in Monte Cristo, formerly Monte Cristo Road, there is a huge queue of people waiting to withdraw money month end. And then you don't see the same in a bank ATM at Klein Vendu. That inequality, business inequality itself stems from a question of, do we do proper analytics? Where people really need the service the most, it is deprived, they are deprived from that service, access to that service. So I think, and then if you have more services, we yet have to see government services, government registration offices, government service providers like your good standings and social security. We have these mindset they must only exist in urban areas. But if you can put a container down, it's how you adapt within the segment of that business. You put a container, for example, in Havana. It's a Nambra container. Mm-hmm. It's a container. It's a social security container, which means that person has the same access to those services as someone who stays in your luxury suburbs. Okay. And that is where data analytics and informality, it's an implementation mandate that must be carried by all the stakeholders, everybody, including myself, ourselves. Everybody should have that mandate. If there's a conference on business activities, it should be closer to the people where they can get intervention.
Yeah.
They don't always have to go to the other side of the Western Bypass to have access to these services. So I think it starts with understanding our in the release of these reports and where we find ourselves in implementing these shortcomings that are identified in those reports.
Mm-hmm. That's a very good observation that you speak about right there, Mr. Rodney. I want to add to that, and this one I actually realized yesterday. Fortunately, yesterday was raining, and getting cab from a clean Windhoek to Katutura, it can be a little bit of a challenge. So I decided, you know what, let me get on the bus, on the municipal bus. And as I did, I asked one of the ladies, because I asked them, does this bus go up until Horiachab or Kapale? And she said, no, it ends somewhere roundabout by the four-way there by Vulman. And I asked myself, but then we're talking about, this is a municipality bus. This is a bus that's supposed to cater for the people. It goes as far as pick them up from Simbabasir, goes as far as picks them up from Groovemo, but when they do get off somewhere by for instance, they can't go further to Akapale, and we have those people that are staying deep in the rural areas. Now, if we're talking about addressing inequality, and yes, we have data that is released, not shying away from the gap that is there, but we have data that is released for us to make decisions that then better enable livelihood for the Namibian people. It's a quite an interesting observation, and you begin to ask yourself to see who then is actually going to implement certain things that need to be implemented for the people. And those buses take actually as far as students that go to university.
Mm-hmm. I hope someone gets motivated by your encounter and your experience, because City of Windhoek sits with planning and spatial data. I was once privy to access one of their files that is very important, mm-hmm. where they can understand the density of property needs and the transport needs that have to evolve around the metropolitan city and then also on the outskirts of Windhoek, because that will help them in terms of achieving their, you know, their long-term goals on how they will collect revenue from land sales.
Yeah.
And if you can tap into the data that they have to understand that you need, I'll use the example of Joburg. If you go in Joburg and you say, I want to go to town, they won't tell you. Sound town was in where? Do you mean CBD? Do you mean western side? Do you mean eastern side? Whereas Windhoek has a very much one-directional approach about town. It is one side.
Yeah.
You must push out the services and then establish very much modernized accommodation to the areas that are behind the Korean hub. And then this must be accessible with all the amenities that same the person is in a different area. So now that reflection, the data, you need to understand the levels, the income levels of the low income, the middle class, and the high income. If you don't do enough to pump enough resource into the middle and low income, that would become a challenge for you, because they are where the big mass and population is. The income data shows that the average income or the average affordability for a house, which is currently 8,000 to 11,000, is way too much.
Mm.
How do you push the benchmark of this cost down to 5,000, 6,000, so that people who can earn in that areas can have, if you, for example, sell an earth at 800,000, you have already excluded. If you look at the income bracket, you will know that you have already excluded possibly 60 to 80% of income. And you look at the age groups. The age groups will tell you most 70 to 61 to 75% of Namibians are young people. Mm-hmm. The employment data will tell you 1.5 million people fall outside the employment, within the employment bracket.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's those who are in the unemployment bracket, 63% of the people are unemployed. Of the population of Namibia, possibly 45% lives in the urban area. So all of these data will tell you that this is how you have to shape that expectation, that people are mass migrating to it. And then if you have these numbers, and then there was actually a question about data once we had a big debate. And then when the recent data says there's 495,000 in Namibia, mind you, that cannot be true. When you say that, how sure are you there's four? It means that 25%, only 25% of the Namibian population lives in Windhoek. it cannot be possible. You get robust figures of between 600,000 to 700,000. Then possibly we can believe you, because there are people who come in Windhoek. It's a cycle of rotation.
Yeah.
Find people that come in Windhoek and live in Windhoek, but they have got a secondary place of residence. They will stay in the north, people mostly that have homesteads, and they will also want to reside in Windhoek. They will stay at the coast, and then they also want to reside at the Windhoek. So in Windhoek. So you have this parallel status of hybridization. People will need to stay in Windhoek because they want access for their children to go to university and live there. So there must be a range in that terms of data, for population data. There must be a range, a upper range and a medium range and a lower range. And I believe that the upper range of traffic, human of the head population, head count of Windhoek will never remain at a figure of 495,000, which was the same figure which was there how many years ago. So those are some of the data inaccuracies which are really having development backwards, because what happens now is more than 200,000 people in Windhoek don't have proper access to a hospital.
Yes.
All of them are piling up. Because this is probably the number that you can assume that they are staying in those outskirts areas. All of them have to pile up and use the emergency center in Karitura. So that basically, that such planning will mean that half of Windhoek population don't have a proper hospital to go to.
Mm-hmm.
So that is, those numbers have to make us come to a realization.
Indeed. Also, why would you say it's important to move beyond numbers or figures and consider the human impact when making policy decisions, recommendations, whether also trade recommendations, making decisions for the livelihoods of the people? I think because sometimes we focus on the numbers, on the percentage, and overlook the fact that these percentages or these numbers actually reflect human figures, human beings, and have real human things.
Kapena we sharadingiryo kuinyanyudha karisho maudhano woko mvogotea kuku Easter Soccer Tournament moike ndanjono erondo. Tuwaimina anopoka pari kwa maudhano kotea kuku mwishitopo rasha eheke district zetunyanyu kilo nipamu. Shinasha nuundunda wa mangeshe fero halandesha radioe yomarandithiro kondandu wa shike uchimari wa chondora matiregeri gatano. Shinasha nuyere na tangu wa wedo wapo watathana na akapa kongo zi honora oheta tuwa imu eriari one ombari eriari onano ondatu no hamano opo imu anene esha radioe.
Human figures, human beings, and have real human tangible impact.
That is a very good question that you have asked. But then data also creates the nuance of being very much myopic in our view. Everybody who is a qualified statistician and a data analyst will tell you, data gives you only a broad spectrum. But if you go down to grassroots level, if you say, for example, the GDP growth of Namibia is 3%, there is always a best case scenario and a worst case scenario. That 3% is favorable to the segment of people who is in the upper quartile of wealth, in the 5%, in the 10%. The negative effect of growth within that segment of that 3% is the one where and big number of people are excluded and is experiencing unemployment and negative growth. So it don't, sometimes data can become an aspect where people only use it as a, the best way is a placebo effect to make you feel good that things are going on a good trajectory. No, every data has got an extreme level and a worst case scenario. Even this year, we give you a prediction of growth. That doesn't mean that will be the actual growth.
No.
I already said that. And I told somebody, do you know that the GDP growth is composed of four quarters in a year? Quarter one, quarter two, quarter three, and quarter four. In most quarters, Namibia has been performing very badly. Why is that figure important? Especially quarter two and quarter three growth has been very tremendously bad, which means it's recessive in its nature. The only reason you get an official recession is when it repeats itself three times, and you don't realize that.
Mm-hmm.
So which means in these quarters, people don't even eat sufficiently. or leave sufficiently. There are seasons where harvest doesn't even take place, where food security is actually hampered. So that, and then people don't get bonuses or extra benefits to have extra exponential income to sustain themselves. They live, the only third time they have to live through debt and enormous financial strain, enormously, and they have to survive those seasons. So what that does is, the data is creating a confusion that things are always very much, you know, that we are in a zone of greenfield, like it's flourishing. No, it's not true. We must tackle the challenges in the seasons where the data is at the extreme lower levels, where you have negative growth, where you have bad policy implementations. If you tackle that one, you create a very health effect or a healthy scenario where you can really, in development or scenarios, the worst and the extreme case scenarios will help you even when the data is positive, having a positive outlook. So I think our focus too much is we want to close the data gaps, and I will say this on record, that makes us look badly in terms of the international market. We want to fill data gaps, for example, where they want to blacklist us, where they want to put us in negative ratings. We want to just fill those gaps. That's not how it's supposed to be. We should fill the gaps, for example, with government data, fiscal data. Don't try to fill the gap to make it look like we are developing, because we will add such and such amount of deficit, and then we will stay healthy. No, because the rating companies will come to knock on our doors if we fall below a certain range in terms of expenditure. No, it is about how do we structure the planning of these financials to make sure that we cut, you know, wasteful spending at a very minimal level, because that is the wasteful spending of government is not a huge aspect where someone spends billions of dollars. No, it starts with wrongful spending of thousands, only thousands of rands or dollars, million dollars.
Yeah.
It's not big. It's about those small reforms that we really need that fills a big gap. In terms of growth as well, let's tackle the small reforms. We need small reforms. When people go to BIPA and say, I have challenge standing in a queue, I have to get my business registered in 2 weeks, that is a bad reform. That is a bad reflection. So we must start with a small component of economic recovery. These are just small things. They are not big in essence. I'm not lying to you.
I hear you.
They are very minute, but they affect 90% of the population every day. It's just that people don't have that voice to complain and say, this is affecting me. Because I'll bring one example up. It is how we set the rate settings of how we charge, City of Velluk charges people for owning a property. When you are adjusting the rate and taxes, when you are adjusting the electricity bills, haphazardly, without considering the income levels of people. You are displacing people from owning houses in the next few years or standing in a queue to have their properties auctioned by the bank. But it starts with the little reforms, the haphazard decisions that are taken every day. And mind you, I will have another narrative I have. If I walk into an office, a public office where I want service rendered, my consideration, if I look between a technocrat young person and a mature person who understands and has experiences, I always walk into the office of the older person, a mature person, because they don't have a defensive approach to things. The technocrats, whenever we are highly exposed to globalized thinking, we make things difficult. We distance ourselves from logic thinking and logic adaptation to solve problems. We always want to be very much intelligent and defend the course of our educational journeys and the trainings we have received or perceived that are good. But we don't think of logical solutions, practical solutions.
Yeah.
That's basically just my everyday motto that I live with.
And that sometimes don't actually cost an arm and a leg. You know, it brings me to this slogan, which I'm not criticizing it, but it's a slogan that we're too few to be poor. Yes, I keep hearing that slogan, but I'm asking myself to see what tangible actions are really being done to address that when Namibia's population is made up majority of 70% of them being youth, and the youth are the one with who are laden with unemployment. We're talking about mental health, we're talking about suicide, we're talking about all these activities that we don't want the youth to engage in. But what is it that we are actually doing tangible to actually incorporate or bring in the youth? What are those reforms that we are doing that are not so difficult to do, just the little things to actually help the youth to get them off the ground and actually help them start up something that is bringing in income, not only for them, but for their family as well.
True. So now, one of the things of being a youth is that you wake up tomorrow and not know wealth at all, because you are the first front runner in your family.
Indeed.
We have spoken about different dispensations in Namibia, but what those with deceptive power do not realize is that the first dispensation of Namibians that actually accrued money, whether it was very aggressive or corruptly, let it do it at the end of independence. Because independence, there's no Namibian who can come forth and say, I was a billionaire in the country with mining rights, with so much land rights, because we were restricted by policy to do so. And then 36 years down the line, the first breed of born-free millionaires will only be established within the past 3 years. But what do they actually need? So it's what we call a head start. So now, if you, for example, there's a narrative of some people being trust fund babies, which basically refers to a notion that the person was born, well, there was money stored up somewhere, and they had a basis where they could start from. But then a person who is now raising up to independent Namibia, nobody had those resources. There was no way that you can say it came 5 years down the line in our generations. Unless you're talking about inheritory wealth of farming and agriculture and all that. But all that was kept minimal so that you could not grow because of the unstable political environment experienced by the previously disadvantaged. That means that within the 36 years already, you have to look at how you can solve the inequality. Let me call it youth inequality.
Yeah.
Youth inequality means that the youth have got a standing challenge of not access to enough job creation opportunities, not enough access to finances, not enough access to, you know, support the environment for them to flourish the business. They need that support. They need government partnerships to flourish. That partnership means when government speaks about public and private cooperation, there's a line that the way it stops. It stops with companies that already have the means of production. And those companies are literally the champions of Namibia, companies that can go out tomorrow and trade with other countries.
Yeah.
They fall within a 2% segment. If it means that we need these companies so much. But if you look at the broad way, we need to unlock MSMEs and youth participation. That is a broad segment. They cannot get access to capital because they don't have enough securities to back up that capital that they need.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have the business experience, and they don't have enough means to scale up even if they do in their production phase. So what do we need to do to ensure that there is sufficient level of transference of wealth down this pyramid of income pyramid to the youth, so that by the time they become 45 and 50 years old, they have, you know, secured enough growth and economic resources for them to pass it on to the next generation. One thing about unemployment and broad unemployment is you don't need to employ people as much as you like. Some people are fall within their margins. That's why when I was speaking about inequality, some people are happy to be in the self-employed category. Don't say they don't want to work. No, they want to be self-employed. They want to be entrepreneurs, and they want their dreams to be self-driven.
Indeed.
It's also a lot of graduates. They don't want just jobs. They want an environment where they can enter AI and the latest digital change in landscape, because they know that after a few years, these things will boom.
Mm-hmm.
The industrial element has already shifted a lot, where a company in AI having 5 employees is making more money from an industrial company where people are working 48 hour non-stop shifts to produce something. So the value of money has shifted to services where it takes less resources but more intellectual exposure. It has shifted already tremendously. So that's why we are living in a space where industrial jobs and all that is already challenged. So for you to embrace and understand the expectations of the youth in the next 5 years, we're talking about a digital era. So that's basically a digital era. That speaks basically about a change in how we have to plan the unlock the jobs for the youth. It will not be manufacturing. It may not be extraction resources. It will just be things like financial services, asset management. It will be computing, digital technology, communication. It will be all in this aspect, because that is where you can get the big value for money. So there's countries that is adapted to invest in these areas, because there is a strong understanding by wealthy countries is that for me to spend time in the field to harvest rice, I will not make enough money.
Mm.
I can just import the rice and then I can spend more of that time making money. But when I import the rice, I get it takes very less of my productive time, and then I don't have to waste my resources on it. But I can sit in the office and then I can render services, sell the oil, sell the crude, mm-hmm. and then I can make money. So that's a trade off, actually. Yes. So that we don't really have to spend all the time just being hardworking, producing goods and services. For us, we have to unlock where we can get value, more financial.
Mm.
That is the value stream that is needed, like tourism, very important aspects. How can we enhance tourism to invite 10,000 people every year, for example?
Mm-hmm.
How can we enhance financial services to employ 10,000 people every year? How can government partner with tourism entities? How can government partner with financial service companies? How can government partner with digital technological companies, the ICT, to create 10,000 jobs every year? That is basically where we need to unlock in creative sector. It does not speak about machinery.
Yeah.
It doesn't speak about industrial products. It just speaks about using the resources we already have, which is the brain capacity of people and the creative capacity of people that we need to unlock.
In other words, what you just said, really utilizing the data to make this also what you call data analysis, data prediction, where you predict where we're going and you see the trajectory also of how things are going and how things are also going in the West, and incorporate all this in order to make decisions that are beneficial for the Namibian people and those that are youth centered.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
Most importantly.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Rudy Orb, I think we cannot exhaust this topic enough, but I thank you so much for the wisdom and the knowledge that you've imparted to us this time around. Thank you so much.
Okay, happy. Thank you very much.
Okay. Now, with this, it is worth noting that data is the backbone of any modern economy, but its true power lies in how it is understood and applied. Institutions like the Namibia Statistics Agency and the Bank of Namibia provide essential information, but it is up to decision makers, businesses, and citizens to use that data responsibly. Most importantly, data should never be reduced to mere numbers. It represents the lived experiences of people, their struggles, of their opportunities, and the future ahead for them. Now, when we recognize this, we move beyond analysis and begin to make decisions that create meaningful and lasting impact in society. And also, it has helped It helps us to address inequality within a society and helps in better decision making, making decisions that benefit the Namibian people as a whole, the Namibian child as a whole. And with that being said, let's pause here now and take a trip to the marketplace. We'll be back with news beyond the borders of Namibia. Stay tuned. Enough for news beyond the borders of Namibia. We always start off regionally, move over to continental news. Thereafter, you can expect international news. Now, let's start off with news regarding China and Kenya deepening their trade ties during a business forum.
China's Vice President Han Jiang and Kenya's Deputy President Kithure Kindiki flag off Kenyan goods for export to China on the standard gauge railway. The train will travel nearly 500 kilometers to the port city of Mombasa, where the goods will be shipped to China.
This confinement marks one of the first Kenyan exports set to benefit from China's zero-tariff policy, which comes into effect on May 1st as the goods arrive in China.
Announced in February, the policy grants zero-tariff access to exports from 53 African countries with diplomatic ties to China. The initiative was a key focus at the Kenya-China Business Forum held in Nairobi, with Kenya's Deputy President highlighting the growing partnership between the two countries.
The relationship has grown into one of Kenya's most important economic partnerships, spanning trade, infrastructure development, manufacturing cooperation, technology exchange, and people-to-people engagements.
The CEO of the China International Exhibition Center, or CIEC, urged Kenyan businesses to take advantage of the duty-free access to expand into the Chinese market.
We are looking forward to seeing more Kenya enterprises engage more actively with the CIECE platform to develop the huge potential of further cooperation between Kenya and China.
Kenyan exporters are also optimistic.
Now let us be strategic through deeper collaboration, through the exchange of expertise, investment, and innovation between Kenya and China. We are building long-term partnerships grounded in shared prosperity.
The day-long forum brought together policymakers and business leaders to explore how Kenyan companies can leverage the new policy to grow exports and boost economic growth. Robert Nagila, CGTN.
And for more on the significance of the Chinese Vice President's visit, we spoke earlier to Professor Peter Kagwanja, President and Chief Executive of the Africa Policy Institute.
At this time when there is war going on in the Middle East, a trip like this is very reassuring to the world that business has not stopped. We are going on with the business. So that's a very important message, which is not safe, but it's a very, very important message from the Chinese Vice President. Second is that Kenya, South Africa, and Seychelles are China's, best partners in the West Indian Ocean, belt. Kenya and South Africa are now the leading exporters of avocados to China, and they are also the prime destination of Chinese investors as well as trade, as well as tourists. The two countries are actually some of the main recipients, together with Egypt and Morocco, of Chinese visitors. So Kenya specifically is on what we call the maritime Silk Road, starting from Mombasa, the inside. So these three countries are very, very important. China and Africa as a whole are the best of partners at this time. You remember the 2024 Beijing summit attracted all the African countries, and that the agreement was done, and that all the three countries plus other African countries are already implementing the FOCAC, plan of action, which started last year and is continuing up to next year. So what that means is that these three countries specifically are China's, have a good relationship with China. They are also China's, trading partners. They are destination for Chinese investors. And they're also a source of products and raw materials for the Chinese, consumers. And therefore, the relationship has been good. The zero tariff, policy from China is basically an olive branch given to Africa at a time when other major countries are basically raising tariffs for African products. Take, for example, the tariffs imposed on small countries like Swaziland. 54% of all the commodities that are going to the U.S. market, for example. And therefore, China has decided at this time that this is the moment to deepen its economic relations and trade relations with Africa. Remember, from 1996, for all those years, China has been the leading trading partner for Africa. So therefore, rather than raise its tariffs, it has decided to basically abolish them for those countries that it has diplomatic relations with. What that means for the continent is that we are going to our exports to China. We are going to have access to the 1.4 billion strong Chinese market, the largest ever in human history. And we are also going to close the gap between our exports and our imports.
Meanwhile, Russia hits UNESCO heritage site in Ukraine in a rare daytime drone attack.
That news that Russia has launched a massive drone attack on Ukraine. In a moment, we'll speak to our correspondent in Ukraine, Vitaly Shevchenko. First, though, let me just show you some quite shocking footage that has just come into the BBC. Well, BBC Verify has confirmed that this video shows a drone striking the historic Bernardine Church and the monastery in the old city of Lviv in western Ukraine. Just we're playing that again for you. The video was filmed from a short distance away in the central square, showing a drone that appears to be a Shahid drone. They're made by Iran, coming down and hitting part of that building, then erupting into flames. Let's speak, as promised, to Vitaly Shevchenko, who's in Kyiv for us. And Vitaly, just start by telling us just more about the scale of this onslaught from Russia today.
It's unusual for an attack of this scale to take place during daytime, particularly in western Ukraine. Such attacks, they happen at night normally because it's more difficult to see the drones, and they focus on eastern, northern, southern and central parts of Ukraine. But this time it's different. Several key cities in western Ukraine have been targeted, as you say, Matthew, in Lviv's historic center. A 15th century monastery is on fire following a Russian attack. A residential building, at least one apartment block, has been hit. Elsewhere in western Ukraine, in Ternopil, a local government building was reportedly targeted. In Ivano-Frankivsk, a maternity hospital has been damaged. So far, I've seen reports of 13 people taken to hospital in Lviv alone, and that number of casualties is expected to rise. There've been hits in central Ukraine as well, in Zhytomyr and Vinnytsia early in the day. In Dnipro, 14-story building was hit by a Russian drone, 12 people hospitalized. So there's a lot of chatter here in Ukraine about this apparently new Russian tactic where drones are flying in broad daylight. Last week on Monday, a Russian drone fell right here in central Kyiv in Independence Square. So there seems to be a change in Russian tactic, and analysts here in Ukraine are trying to figure out what it means.
And what do you think it means in terms of the geography of the attacks, western Ukraine? Tell me about the sort of defenses they have in the west of the country.
Well, for Russia, obviously, there would be targets across Ukraine, military targets, and looking at Russia's past behavior here in Ukraine, it seems that they are not going to stop at hitting civilian targets as well. In terms of defenses, major, bigger cities are, of course, better protected. Ukraine is struggling to cover all of its territory, all of its significant military, civilian infrastructure facilities with proper air defenses now, particularly, especially given that America is distracted by Iran. So not a good time for Ukraine at the moment.
And of course, that is what President Zelensky has been saying relentlessly over the last few weeks as we've seen the war in the Middle East develop. But the fear that Ukraine gets lost, that the attention switches, certainly President Zelensky very, very aware of that, and European leaders very, very aware of that.
It's interesting how little information emerged after the latest round of talks between the Ukrainians and the Americans late last week. All we've seen are pretty bland statements by Ukrainian officials discussing, quote-unquote, ways forward and ways of ending this war. But it's clear that Volodymyr Zelensky is trying to keep Donald Trump on board. He's trying to use Ukraine's drone expertise, drone technology, as a bargaining chip in relations with the United States. And earlier today, I saw unconfirmed reports in Ukrainian media saying that the Americans are pressuring Ukraine to withdraw from the remaining small part of Donbass in eastern Ukraine. And if Ukraine does not do that, Washington threatens to completely pull out of these talks with Ukraine and focus on Iran instead. And that is a prospect that worries Volodymyr Zelensky hugely.
Meanwhile, in other news, the Iran war has widened a rift between the U.S. and Germany. Let's take a listen.
Well, the Iran war is putting further strain on transatlantic relations. German President Frank-Walter Steinmeier has now spoken of a deep rift with the United States. In unusually strong comments, he said that there will be no going back to before January 20th, 2025, when Donald Trump began his second term as president. And he slammed the U.S. administration for starting the war against Iran. Here's some of what he had to say.
Our foreign policy does not become more convincing simply because we refuse to call a violation of international law a violation of international law. We had to grapple with this during the Gaza war, and we must grapple with it in the Iran war as well. For, in my view, this war is a violation of international law. There is little doubt that, in any case, the justification of an imminent attack on the U.S. does not hold water. This view also appears to be held by some within the U.S. intelligence community. This war is also, please forgive me for saying so as someone directly involved, a politically disastrous mistake. And that's what frustrates me the most, a truly avoidable, unnecessary war, if its goal was to stop Iran from developing a nuclear bomb.
Let's get more on this now from our Berlin bureau chief, Max Hoffmann. Max, the German president did not mince his words in criticizing the Trump administration and the war. He called it illegal, avoidable, a disastrous mistake. What do you make of that coming from Germany's head of state?
I was at that speech, which was taking place at the foreign ministry, and I must say the people in attendance were quite surprised that he got so political about this topic, because you have to remember that Frank-Walter Steinmeier, the German president, is the head of state, but he's not the head of government. So he has a largely representative function, and, you know, it's not unheard of that he reminds especially the political parties in Germany of what they're supposed to do, but criticizing an ally like that, that is pretty unusual.
Does this mark a shift, Max, in Germany's foreign policy stances? Is President Steinmeier's position on the war consistent with that of Chancellor Merz?
The German president is not in charge of foreign policy or governing, by the way. That would be the head of government, and that is the German Chancellor, Friedrich Merz. And Friedrich Merz kind of sidestepped the issue of violation of international law in the past, although he has become much clearer on rejecting the Iran war. For example, recently he said, had they been consulted by the U.S., they would have not they would have advised against this war. This was probably almost the strongest phrasing by Friedrich Merz in the past. But again, Steinmeier, the German president, is not in charge of that. And so there has already been some criticism from the party of Friedrich Merz on the comment of Frank-Walter Steinmeier already today, saying that this was not the job of the president, but that was the job of the government to classify this as a violation of international law or not.
Well, President Steinmeier arguably knows what he's doing. He himself served as Germany's foreign minister in the past. Could the president's statement, Max, have political consequences?
Well, he served as a foreign minister actually twice, so he does know what he's talking about. We don't anticipate any direct consequences here, but there could be indirect consequences. For example, sparking a debate in Germany, because a majority of the Germans are not in favor of this war, actually disapprove of it, and also say it is not justified. So that's kind of on the same page as Frank-Walter Steinmeier, and this could have consequences in putting more pressure on the German government, in classifying this officially also as a violation of international law.
How deep is the fracture in transatlantic relations now, Max?
Well, you remember that probably, Terry. A couple of weeks back, the German chancellor was in the United States, and he visited Donald Trump back then. And back then, they seemed to be going along just fine. Of course, a lot of things have changed since then, especially with NATO allies, including Germany, refusing to help with their military means to, for example, secure the Strait of Hormuz. And that didn't please the Americans. That's very clear. So as of now, it's very safe to say that the transatlantic relations have deteriorated in comparison to then. But you know how it is. In these times, it's really hard to say how long that will last.
And with that, we have come to today's conclusion of On the Reading News Analysis. Do stay tuned for the Onkonana Dengue program, brought to you by Louise Shimi and the Home Run Show with Dwight and Helmut from 16:30. Don't forget the Business Economic Segment Show with David Shombe at 1800 hours. From Indafa, happy as usual, it is goodbye. Have yourself a wonderful Wednesday afternoon. I'll see you again same time, same place tomorrow on the Reading News Analysis. Mm-hmm.